At the end of 2020, Utah Foundation released the third report in our Economic Development Incentive Series. The series on state and local incentives addresses the risks that can come with providing public financial benefits to select private parties. The series explores ways to minimize those risks. The third report in the series focuses on local incentives. Cities and counties in Utah primarily rely upon general fund revenues in a mechanism known as tax increment financing, or TIF, to pay for their economic development programs. This report examines local incentive packages through an analytical framework that asks whether they are being used in a manner that is strategic, coordinated, effective, efficient, and transparent. Finally, the report analyzes local interpretations of national accounting standards to determine whether those standards are being followed. Utah Foundation senior analyst Christopher Collard and I sat down to discuss the findings of the report. You'll hear that conversation in this edition of Utah Thrives, the Utah Foundation podcast. I'm Peter Reichard. Christopher, in December, we released our Insights on Incentives report. This report was focused on optimizing local approaches to tax incentives in Utah.
Yeah, so this is a part of a series we've been doing looking at incentives in Utah. We initially started out with a small primer on how local incentives are administered in the state. That kind of raised a number of questions that we wanted to delve a little bit deeper into. Our second report was a report looking at state incentives, specifically, you know, evaluating them on this framework of whether they were strategic, transparent, that they were cooperating with various levels of government, and that they were effective and efficient. And then after doing that report, we decided to kind of apply that same framework to local incentives as we kind of dived deeper into some of the issues we found on our initial primer.
One of the things that was interesting that we found here in this new report was that Utah governments are twice as likely to use tax increment financing to fund economic development when we compare them to national peers. So we took a survey of governments here in Utah and then compared it to a national survey with similar questions. Why is it that our governments are so much more likely to use TIF than other governments are? Maybe first explain what tax increment financing is.
Yeah, governments and people trying to promote economic development, they get really, really creative when trying to find ways to encourage things they want to happen. And so there's really a variety of tools available. Then it comes up with a question of like, how are you going to fund these tools? Where is the money coming from? So you have standard sources of government revenue, but again, people got creative and kind of came up with different ways to make this happen. In Utah, this happens to be kind of this tax increment financing. It really happens to be the tool with the greatest potential of revenue and kind of the greatest flexibility. You can use it to create funds to fund a diverse types of programs. And so that's probably why it's more commonly used in Utah, is it's just the tool with the greatest potential. And so as for what tax increment financing, or we normally just quickly refer to it as TIF, is a system of financing where you pick a project area, you look at the amount of tax revenue that area is currently generating, and you use its current generated tax revenues to kind of establish a baseline. Then you say, okay, we're going to take any new development, you know, any new buildings, any new property development that happens in here is going to create more revenue. We're going to take that new revenue and use that, or the promise of those new revenues, in order to spur something to happen, hopefully something bigger or something that wouldn't otherwise happen, or something that would happen quicker or faster than otherwise. And so the goal is to try and use those future promised funds to kind of spur something happening today. That's kind of the theory behind tax increment financing.
Now, one thing that is interesting in Utah is the fact that we use TIFs based on both property tax and sales tax. Most states don't allow TIF based on sales tax at all.
Tell me why that might be an issue or a problem sometimes to use sales tax increment financing.
So the first TIFs were based off of property tax. And the idea here is the fundamental assumption is without these incentives, this additional development would never happen. If we didn't do anything, nothing would happen here. There'd be no additional revenue. So if we do something promising future revenue, then that future revenue, like we're able to take advantage of something that wouldn't otherwise be there. So no one's losing any money. It's just essentially, it's almost as if in some ways that this development is paying for itself. Is like under ideal circumstances, that's how this is supposed to work. Reality happens to be a little bit trickier. There's a couple of factors to bring into view. Like no one ever knows for sure what's going to happen. So maybe if you just leave this area alone, maybe development might happen. Then there's also like, is this incentive, is it really something new, something that wouldn't happen maybe in a neighboring property? You know, if it's something you're just relocating, then it's not like it's actually generating revenues that wouldn't have occurred otherwise. It's just kind of taking it and relocating it somewhere else. And then honestly, in that case, when it's just relocation, the governments actually end up losing money on the deal because it would have happened without their intervention just somewhere else. And so reality does make these a little bit more complicated. But as people try to find ways to kind of adapt this to different situations, they also expanded it to using sales tax revenues, you know, looking at the sales tax of an area, kind of establishing the baseline and saying, okay, if this new retailer comes, puts their store in here and then, you know, generates additional retail sales for us, we'll give them a portion of those sales back or something along those lines. But the problem is with retail sales, essentially people have an income and then they generally spend that income one way or another. And it kind of, the same share probably goes into retail. So if a new store comes in, it's not so much like it's generating new retail sales overall. It's not necessarily adding new sales to your economy. It's merely relocating it from somewhere else.
So you could be robbing Peter to pay Paul to some extent.
Exactly. And so there's always this. But, you know, property taxes on this other side, it's a little bit more of a solid foundation that you're not necessarily doing that. It's something that you're adding to the tax base. There's not a kind of a limit.
There's a greater chance of that property tax increment being a pure
addition
increment, purely new. Moving on to our other findings now. We did, as I mentioned earlier, compare the trends in Utah to the nation at large. One of the things that we found here was that Utah's local economic development officials report fewer barriers to economic development compared to their counterparts nationally. This kind of raises a question. If you don't have many economic development barriers, then maybe you would be using less incentives, perhaps, than other states might be. Do you have any indication whether that's the case here?
This was a really interesting question. So, I mean, these were, we asked on this survey included 20 potential barriers. And when looking nationally, like local government officials selected almost all of the barriers. I mean, if you look at the least common barrier, still 60% of the national local development officials said it affected them and impacted their jurisdictions. However, in Utah, it was almost like the trend was almost flipped in many ways. We only had 3 of the 20 barriers, you know, surpass 60% of cities reporting that it impacted their jurisdictions. So it was really interesting that I wonder if it reflects a little bit of a different mindset. Many of our political officials here in Utah talk about many of the great qualities of Utah. And you know, we do have an expanding economy and many businesses do choose to relocate here to Utah. And it could be because we have fewer barriers in many of these other areas. And it may just kind of reflect some level of economic prosperity here in Utah. And that does raise kind of this interesting philosophical question. Of, you know, how much do we really need incentives if we have so many fewer barriers? And so it's definitely a question that each kind of jurisdiction is going to have to determine for themselves. And it's part of kind of what we talked about a little bit later, one of the kind of the efficacy of these funds, how much do we deciding if the benefit is worth the cost. With that in mind, you know, 60% of jurisdictions, more than 60% of jurisdictions here in Utah still did report that there are barriers, primarily to do with the lack of land, the lack of building, and the lack of housing. And so, I mean, even though we do have much fewer barriers compared to our national counterparts, they do still exist here in Utah.
As you mentioned at the beginning, we approached this report with an analytical framework that says that economic development incentive programs ought to be strategic, coordinated, effective, efficient, and transparent. As to the first point about it being strategic, in other words, we're focusing on certain things we want to emphasize in our economy rather than having a kitchen sink or just a developer-driven approach. So on that note, there seem to be some positive points here in what we found. For instance, local economic development officials in Utah are more likely to have a written economic development plan compared to officials nationally.
You know, having a plan kind of outlining goals makes a lot of difference. You kind of make sure that you're encouraging development in a way that benefits your city, rather than just kind of choosing the maybe random opportunities that come along. And so Utah does have a greater share of its jurisdictions reporting that they have a written plan out that kind of helps them lead their economic development in the direction that will most benefit their cities.
Mm-hmm. And then as to whether there is coordination, and I guess the idea with coordination is that we don't want withering competition between neighboring jurisdictions, you know, where a project comes along and sort of plays one jurisdiction against the other, creating kind of a race to the bottom as each jurisdiction tries to offer a more generous package. And we don't necessarily cite examples of that happening in our report, but we do know that in the national scene that has been an issue. What was interesting here was that our economic development officials here in Utah report lower levels of competition than nationally. But on the other hand, they also report lower levels of intergovernmental cooperation. Those seem to be kind of, that seems to be counterintuitive.
That is a really good question. And just to be clear, the lower levels of competition and cooperation are in relation for jobs and tax base among local governments in our region. I mean, so this really was kind of directed towards cities in Utah versus other cities in Utah. And so that kind of clarified in some of our discussions with economic development officials, they reported that they have much more competition between regional cities, primarily the Wasatch Front versus other places like Denver or Albuquerque or Phoenix or Las Vegas, as opposed to kind of along the Wasatch Front. So there may be a greater level of competition in that regard. And then regarding levels of cooperation, that was something that I also, you know, we had these results and I was trying to investigate them a little bit more with some of our economic development officials. And some of the jobs, or some of the points they brought up is in many cases, there's kind of this sense of that local governments should kind of stay in their own lane and kind of not necessarily, like there's not a lot of formal ways for cities to cooperate with each other to form kind of this economic development that will be mutually beneficial. It's kind of a city, one city kind of does its own thing and its neighboring city does kind of its own thing, even though they might be working on the same project area that borders each other where they could both benefit. So there's not a lot of formal ways for cities to kind of work together. There are, however, you know, many of these economic development officials did report kind of informal measures. You know, they have these networks where they get together and they can talk about different things that are going on in these cities. They can, you know, if there's a proposal that doesn't work out for them, they'd be willing to shift it on down the line to see if one of their neighboring cities might be interested in that project. At the same time, some of the economic development professionals I spoke with, they were interested in our research, primarily to find out what other people were doing, because they were kind of a little bit territorial, making sure that, you know, not wanting to share their secrets in some ways with other agents. So it's kind of a really conflicting topic out there. It was really interesting, definitely something that I would like to investigate in future reports a little bit more.
Well, and there's also kind of an argument to be made in some instances for not cooperating. And I think of One of the areas of cooperation is state and local. And of course, there's also county, city, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is that in some cases, one jurisdiction or level of government may have a certain set of priorities that they're trying to execute on. And then the other level or entity has a different set of priorities based on what's good for that, for their revenues or for their economic strategy.
Yeah. So that in some ways they're almost like two different classes of coordination. This question specifically from our survey was looking at cooperation and competition from entities on the same level for like among, you know, cities, different cities. But then there's also this aspect of cooperation, you know, among governments of a different level, the city cooperating with the county, cooperating with the state. And while there's no formal structures for cities to cooperate with each other, you know, there are a lot of formal structures for the county, the state, and the city to all work together, along with school districts and other local governments like water districts and that. And the TIF structure, the tax increment financing law that exists in Utah really formalizes these networks and how these entities are supposed to work together. So there's definitely a higher level of cooperation there, where most of these projects are kind of initiated at the city level. The city, through its redevelopment agency or something similar, its land development authority, will reach out to the school district, to the county, to try and get these other local governments on board with also contributing to be part of this project area, where they can also, you know, gain a lot more funds that way. It does kind of bring in this interesting aspect of these, you know, the school district, the county, they have different goals from the city. The school district more especially, you know, highlights it's there to serve students. It's not there to serve kind of the same population of the city. And so it has a different set of needs. And so there's definitely a negotiating that goes on back and forth to try and make sure that these projects are mutually beneficial across several jurisdictions. And definitely there's arguments that a higher level of coordination is more beneficial. But in some ways there's a specific tension because each of these levels benefit in different ways. The state, for example, doesn't collect property taxes. It collects income tax and sales tax. I mean, so projects that increase income or sales tax are going to be the ones it's most interested in. Cities collect sales tax and property tax. So they're going to be interested in projects that increase those. School districts only benefit from property tax. So they have a little bit more of a kind of a focus. And in some ways, you know, if these developments increase housing stock, that adds to the burden of a school district. So a project that asks them to forego that potential revenue from additional housing stock, they're going to look a little bit less favorably on a project that might do that. So there's sure. a lot of different governments with different fiscal priorities and different interests as they each try to protect, you know, as they each work in the best interest of the constituents they serve.
Now, within the question of whether the program is effective, then you have to measure your progress or measure your success. And here's another seeming paradox, but maybe it's not that paradoxical. We found that local economic development officials in Utah are less likely to measure the success of their incentive programs than officials nationally. However, they're far more likely to require performance agreements of their incentive beneficiaries. Can you talk about how those two things may be either paradoxical or related?
There might be a couple things that influence this. We talked a little bit earlier about how more Utah jurisdictions have a written document outlining their goals. Roughly as many jurisdictions in Utah have a written strategy as also measure the effectiveness of their incentives. However, when it comes to performance agreements, many Utah cities might consider this to be almost a default. Because of the structure of this tax increment financing. You know, if these new future revenues never appear, they have no obligation to, you know, provide these incentives to the people requesting them. Because a majority of Utah jurisdictions use TIF to fund their incentives, this performance agreement aspect is almost built in to many of that. And so that might be why Utah has such a higher level of jurisdictions that have these performance agreements. In many cases, cities go beyond this because they have additional requirements such as the number of jobs provided or certain construction deadlines that they might also have agreements to kind of enforce those as well.
If you're just looking at revenue alone, then you may feel comfortable not measuring your success, but for whether the revenue is coming in through the TIF agreement. But if you have other objectives, then you probably need to be taking other steps to measure the success of your program. Is that the gist of it?
Yeah, that might be a good way of kind of summing it up. In many ways, the default, if the incentivized company doesn't meet their end of the bargain, there's no money to give them and they automatically don't receive any incentive. So in many cases, jurisdictions may consider, you know, that this performance agreement is kind of built into to the structure of the incentive. And also it may make cities and counties worry a little bit less about measuring the efficacy of it, because if it doesn't happen, there's no payout.
It certainly does seem like this is something that for jurisdictions that are not really measuring the success of their programs, and they do have multiple objectives, that maybe they would want to take a closer look at instituting some performance measures.
That brings up kind of an interesting point. We've talked about a number of like good practices here, like having a strategic plan, evaluating the effectiveness of that plan. You know, are you meeting your goals? You know, and then we have this third question of like, if the incentive doesn't work out, if the company doesn't bring in what they promised, you know, do you have to end up paying them anyway? These are a number of good of best practices that we discuss that definitely will benefit any city and jurisdiction. But one thing we should also keep in mind is Utah has over 200 cities across the state. Only about 78 of those cities, roughly, have a redevelopment agency. More are probably involved in some form of economic development, but only about 80 of them have enough dedication to have formed a redevelopment agency. And these cities really vary in the size and scope. I mean, they're all across the state. And each one of them have really different capabilities. Like Salt Lake City is a very, in many ways, a sophisticated entity when it comes to economic redevelopment. Other cities are much newer to the table and don't have the institutions in place or the practices in place to make sure that they're doing this in the most effective way. But they also have, you know, smaller cities have limited resources. They might only have an economic development staff that only is working part-time on that while they also juggle other city responsibilities. So there's really a wide array in city sophistication and the resources that each city can dedicate to this as well. So that's also
something. So there may be some capacity issues for some jurisdictions that limits their ability to effectively monitor and measure the success of their program.
Yeah, and that's definitely everyone faces. Like, it's always a trade-off between how much of your resources do you want to dedicate on making an impact versus measuring whether that impact happens. It's definitely a balance that everyone has to deal with.
Moving on to the issue of efficiency. Now, ideally, any revenue that goes out would be revenue that would not exist but for the development. From the taxpayer standpoint or from the public standpoint, the optimal approach would be for the least amount of tax revenue to be sacrificed for the development as can possibly happen. But what we found in our report was that there are a lot of different conceptions of what that but-for test means, that but for the development, this revenue wouldn't happen. Can you talk about some of those different viewpoints on it and then kind of what the significance of those differences means in terms of the approach that local governments take?
So when analyzing a project, local governments essentially face kind of three different questions. The first question is, you know, if they don't do anything, will something of comparable value happen anyway, or in a near enough timeline that's acceptable to them? I mean, that's kind of what we're talking about when we're talking about a but-for test. You know, without this, without a specific government action, will cities receive the same benefit? And, you know, if you have a raging economy and low cost to land and good utilities, in many cases, economic development will occur whether or not the city gets involved. And so that's kind of this first test is does the government really need to get involved in this area to make sure it's successful? In many cases, there may be something problematic about this specific property. It may be held up in court somehow with legal problems. It could be an area that's somehow been badly used and there's some remediation, or it might just be the cost of redevelopment, of knocking down whatever is existing. You know, so there might be these additional barriers that prevent it, that then a government does see, you know, if we don't step in, if we don't help out, there's nothing really feasible that would happen here. And so that's kind of the first question, this but for question that we tried to get at. And, you know, as we asked these different cities, you know, a little bit over 40% kind of talked about that they kind of took this approach, that they looked at reasonable alternatives when kind of considering, you know, the different potential outcomes here. Other cities, you know, then there's this different question of like, if there's a specific project planned, you know, somebody's come to you with this idea, we'd like to do this here. We can't quite make our project work out. There's something inhibiting our project. And this is generally thought of as like a gap analysis. You know, there's something with this project that's inhibiting it. It might be one of the factors I mentioned earlier. Is there no other way for the private entity to get these funds? Are there not any investors in the area or willing to kind of help out? Are there no alternatives, that it has to be the government to come in to help and bridge this gap? And so that's kind of this test of, you know, without this government invention, this specific project wouldn't happen. 80% of cities kind of at least asking this question. Very few are not kind of asking this question. And in many cases, there's a slight variant where maybe the city is bridging the gap to make sure it happens in the way they want, either on an earlier timeline or maybe in the right place of the city, or maybe instead of having a large area of parking lot, they make structured parking to kind of encourage the type of development they're looking for. And then there's kind of the third final test is, you know, if this government investment is really necessary to make this project happen, then it comes down to like, is it worth it? And you have your cost benefit analysis. You're asking, you know, is the result that they're promising worth the government's investment? And again, around 80% of jurisdictions in Utah are using this as they're looking at these projects.
When they ask that but for question, it could mean different things though. It could mean, but for this public investment, this particular idea developer X has will not come to fruition. Or it could be, but for this investment, no development will happen at this site in a reasonable time frame. So you have different variation among local governments, not only as to the rigor of their analysis, but also what the foundational question of the analysis is.
Yeah, we do see a lot of these differences, and some of these differences reflect probably sophistication. Some of these differences just reflect the city's goals, whether they're eager to encourage development. But you know, the cities who are most worried about efficiently using their funds are going to kind of approach this with the hardest questions. They're the ones, you know, the ones who are most worried about efficiently using their funds. They're going to be the cities and the jurisdictions that are going to be asking, you know, if we don't do anything, will something comparable happen? You know, how necessary is this? And will it actually be worth our money?
When we put a study together, we do want to help policymakers to improve public policy. And that typically happens after the report is released. In this case, there were policy changes that were starting to happen as a result of this report, even before it was published. So we can go back to early last year with the very first report, where we just simply raised questions about whether local governments in Utah were following the national accounting standards set by the Governmental Accounting Standards Board for reporting incentives. There is a statement called Statement 77 that they released a few years ago that pertains directly to the reporting upon the incentives. And we kind of got some pushback from local governments saying that we had it all wrong and there was no need to report at the level that we were suggesting because of we were misunderstanding the language. With that in mind, we went to the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, GASB, interacted with them, did a deep dive analysis on that statement 77, and then came to the state auditor with some initial findings. What happened after that, Christopher?
Yeah, so after we came to the auditor with our findings, we kind of had a discussion with the auditor's office. The state auditor doesn't evaluate cities on whether they're following national standards or not. That's actually the role of an independent auditor that each jurisdiction should hire. But what they did is they did kind of look at this, and they looked at our preliminary findings, and they concluded that we were right. This statement, this specific standard, was not well understood, not being properly understood by most local jurisdictions here in Utah. And so they're currently in the middle of drafting kind of an auditor alert to kind of call this out to the attention of all the private auditors that are in charge of auditing financial documents for cities and counties and local governments, to kind of bring this to their attention and make sure that they are also paying attention to it.
Why is it important?
Transparency is definitely one of the important aspects, something we focused on in this report, because, you know, this is an expenditure of public funds. Citizens are more trusting of a government when they can see where the money is going. Currently, trying to find out, based on current statutes and current availability of data, finding out specifically how much money is being paid out to a private entity using public funds is nearly impossible to find on an aggregate scale. It's not something that is currently required by Utah statute. We do have great data on TIF funds. That's tax increment finance. It comes in through property tax collections. It gets redirected to redevelopment agencies. That money is really easy to track. However, not all of that money goes to incentives or payouts to private companies. A lot of that money goes towards building infrastructure. A lot of that money might go towards bonds for recreation centers. There's a lot of different ways that money can be spent. But specifically, the amount that goes to private entities as like a cash distribution, that's a really hard number to find. Some cities do report it. They elect to report it either in their budget or in their annual financial report, but it's not a common thing. It's something we had a really hard time finding it, and there was no good way to aggregate it. However, you know, while that's not required by state statute for redevelopment agencies to report that, they do report a lot of other information in public meetings and in their public budgets and in their annual reports. It is required by, based on this statement 77, that's essentially the target of this statement, is like, let's look at the stuff that the city or the local government should be collecting but isn't, because it's either just waiving it, saying you don't have to pay that tax, or they're kind of redistributing it, refunding it to the entity somehow, like we do here in Utah. And so that was kind of, as we tried to chase this number down, we realized, hey, this number isn't out there and it should be. And so that's kind of how we dived more into this and tried to understand better what cities were misunderstanding, what counties and school districts weren't really understanding about this, and whether they should be. Yeah.
And we have been getting some better information on bigger picture questions. So for instance, after our last report was released, the legislature took some action to require a bit more transparency. And then Salt Lake County has undertaken some work to report out on redevelopment areas as well. Can you talk about some of those efforts?
Yeah, so one of the hardest things with transparency on this issue is just the fact that it's happening at so many different levels. You have agreements with cities, you have agreements with school districts, you have agreements with counties and local governments like cemeteries or water agencies or police districts or mosquito abatement districts. And just the fact that it's happening on so many different levels across all different cities and different geographies just makes it really difficult to aggregate the data. And so that's one thing that kind of came out of our preliminary report, is, you know, the subsequent legislative session, the state legislature kind of required the state to find a way to, they were already producing a lot of transparency data in their annual reports, But really, that bill was all about compiling it into a single database where you could, you know, kind of collectively look at things together. And a lot of information will be there. But again, it is still missing that one piece of information that we were looking for that we couldn't find, of how much public funds, how much of the taxes are specifically being paid out to companies as a financial incentive. That's still not there in those reports, but it should be through these financial statements that cities and local governments are required to publish every year.
Well, certainly a very important topic for citizens to pay attention to. Certainly, we hope that this report will be very useful to our local officials who are looking to make their incentive programs as strategic, efficient, effective, transparent, etc., as they can be. Thank you very much, Christopher.
This has been Utah Thrives, the Utah Foundation podcast. Follow our work at utahfoundation.org.